One in five Americans has learned a new language on their bucket list, or life backlog, if you will. If that's you, make 2024 the year you finally check it off the list with Babbel. Upgrade your personal skill set in 2024 with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Its tips and tools are approachable, accessible, rooted in real-life situations, and deliver with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. I have a trip to Mexico coming up, so I've been using Babbel to brush up on my Spanish. The courses are short and sweet, so I can do one whenever I have a few minutes to spare. And the words and phrases it teaches you are designed for practical, real-world use, like ordering at a restaurant or asking for directions. Babbel can even provide you feedback on your pronunciation with its speech recognition tech. And it's not just for Spanish. Babbel includes 14 different language courses, each backed by a 20-day money-back guarantee. Here's a special limited-time deal for Scoop Nation. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, only for our listeners, at babbel.com/gamescoop. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/gamescoop, spelled BABBEL.com/gamescoop. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Hey there. Ever wonder what happens to all those amazing screenplays that never make it to the big screen? Wonder no more. Welcome to Table Read Podcast, where we bring those undiscovered gems to life. Picture this, talented actors giving incredible performances with the occasional laugh or blooper thrown in, produced by award-winning pros. From drama to comedy, TV pilots to feature films, there's something for everyone. And guess what? We release new episodes every week, so don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Table Read Podcast, where great stories finally get their chance to shine.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to day two of Gamescom here on IGN. I'm your host, Damon Hatfield. We're opening today's show with my absolute favorite podcast, GameScoop. But first, later on today, you can look forward to seeing more of Little Nightmares 2 and The Medium. But right now, is on to the scoops. Joining me today is Tina Amini.
Hello.
Sam Claiborne.
Hey, everybody.
And Justin Davis.
Scoop.
Scoop to you all. We have a great show for you this week. We're going to talk about who Sony has deemed worthy of pre-ordering a PlayStation 5. We've got new details on Lord of the Rings, Gollum. But first. Yeah. Butts first.
I like that. And I gotta say, that was a great read. You're doing a great job, Damon.
Thank you. Thank you. I was very nervous. new rumors. Actually, let's go this route. Rumors about a new version of the Switch, the Nintendo Switch, are not new, but new rumors have surfaced this week. This is according to a report from Economic Daily News. EDN, the new version of the Switch is set to launch at retail first quarter 2021. Early next year, report claims to be informed by sources in the console's supply chain, says the new version of the Switch will feature improved interactivity and a better quality display. Like I said, the rumors about this sort of thing are not new. Tina, what's your read on this one? How likely is this to come to pass?
You might say they're renewed rumors, Damon, because you're right. It's been kind of like a suspicion for a while, and it would not be outside the norm of what Nintendo could do in terms of making sure they're sustaining the life cycle of the Switch. I know a lot of people wanted a Pro Switch. There's obviously a lot of conversation around the power not exactly being up to speed in terms of the current generation, and especially as we're entering in the next generation, it's kind of becoming more important for Nintendo to make sure that they can step up on a graphical level as well as the convenience level, because there's so many gamers that love the option of having to play their game on Switch rather than PS4 or the Xbox, because you can just take it around with you. It's incredibly flexible. So if they are able to increase up to like 4K support, for instance, I think that's going to be the kind of thing that brings them a little bit up to speed as we head into the next generation.
Now, Tina, you sound a little quiet on my end. I don't know if there's anything you can do on your end, or Chris, who's our TD working behind the scenes, maybe he can work on that. But to get some more views on this, Sam, I believe you've said very recently that you don't think we even need a new version of the Switch. Is that still true?
Yeah, so what I think now is that there's probably a good reason that the new Switch is going to happen no matter what. Like, I think like there are parts of that Switch that are 3 or 4 years old that are harder to get now than new parts that are better. We're going to, you know, like if there's like, that's what's funny when you brought up the supply chain part of this, like if they're actually going to keep on making Switches, and remember, it's hard to get a Switch right now.
Yeah.
That's a problem, right? So if they want to get more people Switches, they might need to change that up. And if they're going to do that, they might as well upgrade it. So the screen is more definition as a new processor. Those are like two easy things to kind of go for. And then battery is the other one, right? But those two are interesting because I think that Switch is nice when it can pace along with having the things like The Witcher and Witcher 3 and contemporary games on it like Doom. If it can't do Cyberpunk, if it can't do the things that are still like current generation but are coming at the end of this generation, then I think that's a problem. And that's where I'd like to be like, okay, well, if I'm really being honest with myself, I would love to play Cyberpunk on my Switch. I know it'll look worse. I don't care. It's a giant RPG that I'd want to like just veg out in bed and play, you know?
Justin, I don't know, what do you think?
Yeah, I consider these, you know, rumors or renewed rumors, as Tina put it, extremely credible and plausible. You know, it would explain a lot. It would explain why their release calendar for the second half of this year is so light to non-existent. You know, the teams, the intern, you know, the subtext being that the teams are probably working on, you know, Switch Plus games. I'm less sure, that being said, that they can make an upgrade to the Switch hardware that doesn't necessarily make it more powerful. The screen, and I, to be clear, I love my Switch, but in the year 2020, the battery life is very bad. The screen is not incredibly high quality, and it actually has a huge black bezel around the edge. So there's an opportunity. You can see it right there on the screen. Like, they wouldn't even need to change the Switch form factor at all and just make that screen edge to edge. Improve the battery life and make improvements like that without necessarily having to make a console that can do 4K output on a TV or something like that. So I'm curious to see which direction they go. Like, is it truly a Switch Plus that can do 4K, you know, when docked and that has more horsepower? Is it just sort of like a Switch Plus that has the same internal components, but maybe is just a little bit, you know, nicer and premium feeling?
Tina,
it's
you
funny
played,
to think or, that we're, ahead. Well, I was just going to say to Tina's point, like we're about to enter an era in which like we all have 4K TVs, and that's never stopped Nintendo from not updating before. But if we all have 4K TVs and we're plugging in something that doesn't have 4K, it's going to start feeling silly really soon. And maybe they'll start caring about that.
Well, you're so right about Cyberpunk though, Sam. We're like, it's already, you know, even a newer, more powerful Switch is either not going to be powerful enough to run Cyberpunk, or even if it is, it's going to look so much worse and inferior to the version that you can get on the other consoles that like, it's almost harmful to Nintendo to like run in that direction. Like, because then they're inviting a direct one-to-one comparison that they kind of don't want.
Although in a weird way, like the community has kind of just embraced the fact that that's not what you get when it comes to Nintendo systems. Like what you're getting is that convenience factor. You're getting a machine that houses a lot of like other really adorable gems that you can play, you know, from your couch or on the go. So I think it, like, we constantly see those kind of graphical comparisons, especially when the current gen launched. We constantly saw those kind of comparisons. We do those kind of comparisons where we say, like, here's a game, you know, as compared to on an Xbox versus a PlayStation. So it's kind of part of the culture, as opposed to with Nintendo, that's not exactly the expectation. So I imagine if they go the route of what they did, you know, with their actual handheld consoles and just kind of extended the screen and improved the battery life, as you were saying, Justin, like, that would totally be a viable option for them that I imagine people would get on board with because they like the environment in which they have become accustomed to using their Switches.
Nintendo has a history of doing this with its handhelds. There was the Game Boy Advance, then the Game Boy Advance SP. There's the DS, and then the DSi. Yeah, it's interesting to think that this whole time, the almost 4 years that the Switch has been around, 3.5 years, the sort of ecosystem or the game library is all those incredible Nintendo exclusives, a lot of indie games, and then a sort of a steady stream of ports from older games from this generation that might not be the best way to play them, but they run and they're portable, which is nice to have. But as the the next-gen consoles launch, PS5 and Xbox Series X, the Switch will, at the power it's at now, it's really going to start being left behind. So I would love to see a slightly more powerful Switch coming soon, you know, soon after the console launch. Tina, you played The Witcher 3 on your Switch. Like Sam, would you also prefer to play Cyberpunk on it?
No, the reason why it worked, and I was going to mention that too, the reason why it worked for Witcher 3 is because I was late to it. So it felt like the kind of game that I could chip away at in between moments. So, you know, if we're traveling somewhere, or if I'm at, like, you know, staying with my brothers or something, like, it's an easy thing for me to fit in. But for a new game like Cyberpunk, I think I'm going to want to experience that the same way everyone else is experiencing it, since I'm going to be experiencing it at the same time too. Makes a difference.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah, I want that's like the sort of like the big premiere game that's closing out this generation and launching the next one. So yeah, I want to play that on my big 4K TV. If this new model of the Switch is coming early 2021, Sam, what do you think about the prospects of Breath of the Wild 2 sort of launching alongside it to launch this little, you know, more powerful version?
There's a big problem with that, and that's that Nintendo has never done. So you were talking about the history of Nintendo having like the SP out, or the DSi was a version of the DS, or the you know, the 3DS has some iterations. They're not like 0.5 steps like the, you know, like the Xbox One X or the PlayStation 4 Pro. They're not like that. Those are like very incremental, and they can still play the old games. And there was very few exclusives that were kind of for those newer systems. For Nintendo to do like a full 0.5, they would have to do something like that. They would have to say like, come play this on the new system, or play this much better version of it to pull people over. And I don't know if they're inclined to do that. They normally just want to make that sea of things out there that can play Pokemon bigger and bigger and bigger. So it's hard for me to like see them say right now, like, stop using your hardware, use this new hardware. But if they're going to do that, it would really help to have a new Zelda. I mean, that's how you get the hardcore people over there. It'd be kind of mean, but it'd work.
Justin, what do you think?
Well, it really calls into contrast for me, or you know, makes me think about, we mostly talk about and consider the Switch as a home console. But Nintendo doesn't have a portable anymore. This is their only console, and it's the first time in Nintendo's history ever, you know, since the Game Boy, that they have not been a handheld and home console company. And so, you know, everyone talks about how the Switch is a runaway success, and it's going to end up being, it's probably going to surpass the Wii as being their best-selling console of all time. But in the back of my head, I'm always thinking about, like, they sold 150 million DSs, and that business is just gone now. Yeah. So, you know, where they take that Switch line is going to, I think, solidify for me how Nintendo is thinking about the Switch. Is it more like the DS, where, you know, they had three, you called out the DSi, Damon, but they also had the DS Lite, you know.
That's right. That's right.
So they've iterated on that, you know, a lot of times. Or does Nintendo in their own head sort of think about it a little bit more as a home console? It's a hybrid. It doesn't have an analog. It occupies a really interesting space in the company's history and in gaming history, where I think it gets a little bit hard to look at what happened in the past and draw conclusions about the future.
Sam, it's interesting. You said Nintendo wants to have as many devices out there that play Pokemon as it can, but has that changed to as many devices out there that can play Animal Crossing?
Yeah, seriously, that must have been blowing their minds when that was happening earlier. Yeah, I think they want people to go on to another game now. So I think that's like a big scramble at Nintendo, is like, what's the big follow-up that will be a worldwide hit like Animal Crossing, which I don't think they really anticipated.
Yeah,
because how could they? It was because of a world event that nobody anticipated that we all played Animal Crossing, probably. We don't have a B universe to compare A universe to at this point.
Yeah, I wish we did.
Yeah.
That we know of.
We're in the B universe.
Well, how do we get there? Yeah, exactly.
Okay, that's a good stopping point. We have to take a quick break, but when we return, there's going to be even more scoops. So many more scoops for you to just scoop right up and pour all over your face and write down your guzzle. We'll be right back.
Gross.
Welcome back to Game Scoop on Gamescom here on IGN. This is day two of our Gamescom coverage. And if you are tuning into Gamescom and actually not super familiar with Game Scoop, it's our weekly podcast where we talk about all the latest news happening in the world of video games. You can find it in your favorite podcast service or at youtube.com/gamescoop. It's a really fun show. I like it. I'm a fan. I don't care what anybody says. I like GameCube. Joining me, or not joining me, still with me are Tina Amini, Sam Claiborne, and Justin Davis. And we were talking about Nintendo, the Nintendo rumors of a new Switch, but now we're going to move on to PlayStation. PlayStation 5 pre-orders have not gone live yet. We don't know when it's coming out. We don't know how much it's going to cost, but Sony has started the process of letting people know that not very many people are going to be able to pre-order it. So
this is the picture of the raffle that we're watching right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, exactly. Is it a raffle? I don't know if it's a raffle. Sony is giving fans a chance to be one of the first people to pre-order the PS5. Sony says there will be a limited quantity of PS5 consoles available for pre-order. So I don't know. It sounds like it might be kind of hard to get at launch. Those who are interested to potentially receive an invitation to pre-order can share your PlayStation Online ID. And then if you are selected, Sony will email you the instructions to secure a PS5 at launch. The selection of who gets chosen for a PS5 pre-order, this is my favorite part, is based on previous interest and PlayStation activities. So, your PS4 is connected online and Sony's been gathering all this data about you over the past 7 years, and it knows how many platinum trophies you have. So it knows how hardcore a fan you are.
Trophies finally matter.
I don't know how it's gauging previous interest though, and then unless they're just looking at how much is your account spent in the PlayStation store.
I have an alternative perspective. Okay. Allow me to present a different theory, which is all of this is lies, and it's just marketing.
Well, I was going to ask that too.
We don't know. I don't know if we're even going to have any PS5. You better give us your credit card number now. Otherwise, we're not sure you're going to be able to get one in the next year.
Go ahead, Justin.
No, I'm just goofing.
Oh, I actually saw some of our commenters were saying the same thing. Like, is this manufactured shortages so that you're drumming up more interest and drive to kind of get your hands on one of these things? But two things to that. One is that a bunch of other commenters were also really pissed about it. And I think it's the first time that I've seen our community react that negatively towards something, especially PS5 related, but just kind of Sony PlayStation in general. So that was an interesting new angle to the conversation around the PS5 that I haven't really seen before. So if it was for that purpose, it's definitely had a negative backlash, but maybe it is that kind of scenario where only the people who didn't get selected to be the chosen ones, are the ones left to be upset, and then everyone else gets to kind of gloat over it. Yeah. But the second point that I had to that was that a few months ago, we drafted a reported feature piece talking to a bunch of analysts about the potential for delays for the consoles, and they hadn't predicted delays, but they were pretty much across the board universally in agreement that there'd be massive shortages. And obviously due to the pandemic, a lot of companies that they're working with, production companies, are globally situated. Everybody's in a different scenario with COVID-19. So who knows what their protocols are, how much they've been impacted. And then even just distribution centers after that, who knows what's going on with retailers on top of it. So they were definitely pretty sure there were going to be shortages. So that does at least track with what Sony's new rules and regulations around getting a PS5 are.
Yeah, I mean, all goofing aside, I think the truth is probably somewhere in the middle, right? Like, they're in the business of making sure that anyone that's kind of a fence sitter on the PS5 buys one right away. So I do think some of it's marketing, but then I do think that they're also expectation setting on, like, look, there are not going to be millions and millions of these things on store shelves. And there's actually an interesting, wrinkle here, which is Sony is selling PlayStation 5s direct on PlayStation.com, which is fairly unusual and new. Normally, there is no direct sales business. You partner with Walmart and Amazon and Target and sell your consoles that way. And they make a lot more money for each game console that they sell directly to consumers instead of wholesaling them out to retailers. So some of this may be a gambit to try to to sell hardware direct to consumers instead of working with third-party distributors like that.
Yeah, I was going to make that exact point and add to that that if you're freaking out about not being able to get a PlayStation right now because of this message, just remember you still won't be able to get one on Best Buy, Amazon, everywhere else. You normally have to refresh a web page on. It's going to be hard.
But it wasn't. But, it wasn't hard to get PS4 pre-orders when they went live.
No,
2013.
But that was also at E3. That was in the summer.
I know.
Yeah, some of the pre-order situations have not been as bad in the modern era, but you know, everybody has like really bad memories of that PS3 Wii era launch, which was just like lines in the winter and stuff like that. So I think we're probably looking more at that, and then also just like tons of reselling. Like these things are going to be so expensive on the secondhand market right away.
Yeah. I think part of the frustration that, you know, Tina noted from, you know, our audience and just the gaming audience in general is that we still don't have the price. And so it's beyond ridiculous at this point that like pre-orders are coming soon. Give us your email and we'll let you know if you can pre-order it. And it's like, dude, we need to know how much this thing costs before we can continue this conversation.
Yeah. Are they trying to get everybody invested before they can withdraw their pre-orders upon seeing a price?
Yeah.
There's another conspiracy theory for you.
That's a good conspiracy theory. And that's you know, when you line stuff like that up, like some of the things that Sony's probably doing not on purpose, like is probably working to their advantage. And they're like, hey, this is great. Because I just feel like this is like one of those marketing beats. And there's a few others that were probably planned. I think they probably thought they'd have a price by now. I don't know. It just seems like things are starting to happen out of order. Like the price moment, they didn't do it, but it's fine. They're still doing all this other stuff. It seems strange.
I'm worried that the lack of these consoles having a price means they're going to be expensive.
Because that's the bad news, right?
I think if these consoles were going to be at a price that they thought wasn't going to be seen as bad news, they would have been in more of a hurry to share, here's our console price. I think that every day that goes by is more and more of a signal that they're going to be pricey.
Yeah, absolutely. It feels like the game of chicken is just continuing to where, like, who's going to be the one to break the bad news to the community and therefore get the flack associated with it?
Yes.
So it's definitely postponing that as long as possible. And it's why we're about to head into September without any solid concrete details about when we'd get these things or for how much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost September. We still don't know how much these things are going to cost. Those who are selected to pre-order the PlayStation 5 can order the following if they choose. One PS5 console or digital edition, two DualSense controllers, two charging stations, two 3D wireless headsets, two media remotes, and two HD cameras. Although it's not clear to me why you only have one console. Why do you need two HD cameras?
Or two remotes.
Or two remotes. I thought that was a little...
TV. When I stood in line for a Wii when I was in college, I got through the line. They only had 20, but there was, and they kept saying that all day, but there was like 65 people in line and I was number 19 and I was really happy about that. So I got in the store, you know, like I was guaranteed a Wii. Everybody was really mad outside, even though they'd been told all day not to wait, there wasn't any more. And then they walked us through this gamut of like accessories and it was like these long tables laid out and it was like, here's the games, you know, I really had to have Zelda, right? And here's the other Wii remotes, and like here's like everything else. And that's such a funny digitized version of that exact process.
Yep.
Yeah, I've been around for almost all the console launches. I've never seen a console launch or pre-order system work like this. I don't know.
Well, and it's all digital. We mentioned, you know, it won't be on store shelves because there are no store shelves. So that's like another change this fall is that like if one thing about store shelves is that it prevents this kind of disruption of like tomfoolery on the internet. If you can only order a PlayStation on the internet, like that's going to be exploited and messed with. So, you know, if somebody out there can buy 500 PS5s and sell them in the secondhand market, they're going to do that. And like the thing standing in the way before was, you know, Target and GameStop and everything, which had like a different system by which they are distributed.
Yeah, but they can't. I think that's actually a really good point. We saw that with like the Nintendo Switch, where a lot of people had anxiety about, you know, oh my God, I couldn't get a pre-order, I didn't get one, and now they're sold out. And then almost as an afterthought, they're like, oh yeah, I can go to a store and buy one. Like, that's all. And then like you saw these comments of like, I walked in on launch day, I picked one off the shelf, I bought it, it was easy. Like,
and there's pictures on Twitter, like that whole launch weekend of like, oh, look how many there are at this place. And that was cool.
But not at the very least for this pre-order phase, they're only allowing you one console. And I have to imagine even, you know, after that, they're going to be limiting it too, especially because of the shortages, but also because of resellers online for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is a conversation I was having with Seth Macy, earlier this week. He pointed out that the Switch has been the best-selling console of the year so far, you know, likely because the other consoles are very late in their life cycle. The Wii's the Switch is only a few years old, and there's lots of excitement around it. But he said that's all going to change when PlayStation 5 comes out. PlayStation 5 will be the best-selling console, you know, for its launch month in December. But now I wonder if that like can't be true, if it's too limited, if both the PlayStation 5 and Xbox Series X are out, and the Nintendo Switch, the current model, outsells them in this holiday season.
Yeah, I'm sure all 500 PS5s will be sold.
It'll depend on how many they can make.
Yeah, they'll sell out. They can always say that. That's the marketing beat they can hit. Also, it's possible that Switch will be more popular. It could be, you know? I mean, Switch is just a different audience. Like, we haven't hit the holiday season cycle with Animal Crossing yet. That's a big deal. Some people don't buy a system all year long, you know? Like, we're probably going to hit that. And Animal Crossing is going to go hard for wintry updates and cool, like, you know, like holiday lights and stuff in town. Like, it's going to go. I just experienced all that because I'm in the Southern Hemisphere.
Switch has also never had a price drop. You know, the $200 Switch Lite is its normal price. So if they go to $150 and $250, like, that's a huge ace in their hole, potentially.
Yeah.
Ace in their pocket.
No, I think ace in the hole's right.
Ace in the hole. Right. Ace in their pocket. Yeah.
Got it. Thank you.
Eight ball in the pocket.
Okay.
Or that.
Wait.
Anyway, I don't know. Exclusive pre-order system for a PS5. Did anyone like submit their PlayStation Online IDs and try to get in? Mm-hmm. You did? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's part of your job also, right? To be fair. Yeah. Like, I didn't bother with it.
I'm trophy master too.
When
he gets the PS5, he'll keep it in the box too, no less.
That's true. I will not be opening the PS5. I got the Nintendo at Lego set.
And didn't open it.
But did not open it.
And it's a very big box.
Okay, we have to take another quick break, but Game Scoop will return after this. Welcome back to Game Scoop on Gamescom. This is day two of IGN's live Gamescom coverage. Coming up a little bit later today, we've got new looks at Little Nightmares 2 and The Medium. But right now, we're going to get back to talking about PlayStation stuff. We're talking about the bizarre exclusive pre-order system for the PS5. But earlier today, we got to see an extended gameplay demo of a very impressive-looking PS5 game, Ratchet & Clank Rift Apart. Let's bring in Tina, Sam, and Justin once again. I continue to be very impressed with this game. Tina, what do you think?
It was very much a big part of their last presentation, so it wasn't, I suppose, as a big reveal as the first time we saw the extension of this, or rather the cut down version of what appears to be the level that they showed off. So it looked just as good as the first time. I do find it kind of interesting that they're really pushing the narrative about this is what the power of the PS5 can do. And granted, their first presentation of that was in association with the Unreal Engine demo, which wasn't exactly a game, but you know, you had a human character in there. You had these realistic looking environments. Obviously, Ratchet & Clank is a slightly more cartoonish with this like realistic kind of graphical edge to it. So there's a lot of particles flying around. You can see the reflection of windows from the buildings. On the floor, there's just a ton going on, and obviously the rifts acting as a portal is the biggest, I guess I would say, like next gen part of that presentation. But it is interesting that they're continuing on that beat with this game as being like a prominent example of what next gen can deliver.
Yeah, and it's coming from Insomniac, who's also delivering Spider-Man Miles Morales at launch, and Ratchet and Clank is supposed to be a launch window game. So, man. And Insomniac is really sort of the VIP for Sony heading into next gen. Justin, what did you think of today's gameplay demo?
I thought it was really beautiful and impressive. I liked it a lot. Like, you know, I think it's occupying a gameplay space with sort of like, you know, shooting and platforming that we don't see as much anymore. Feels a little bit like, you know, a modern take on a throwback. And even just a tone space of like, it feels like a game that's for 12-year-olds, where like most games are either, you know, for little children or for adults, and we don't get that much stuff that exists kind of in the middle. And I really liked it. I want to play it. I used to be a fan of the Ratchet and Clank games, and then, you know, fell off of them. And I'm excited to give this one a shot this fall.
But Sam thought it was just the same damn demo.
Yeah, well,
I mean technically, you know, it was. Extended.
There's what I would have liked to see in this demo is what we all want to see, which is like, you know, the Vortex stuff being shown off a lot. And, you know, shown off a little bit, but not in the sense that, like, I thought you could, like, I thought I would like to see the idea of, like, where you can, like, walk around and just zip through them over and over again. Like, I really want to see that as, like, the tech demo I want to see. But this is, like, more of gameplay. And I don't mind seeing gameplay because gameplay helps me make the decision about whether I want to play a game or not. And this does not look like a game I want to play. It looks more like a Lego game where you just kind of run through it and shoot things. Like, I need to see some platforming or some creativity around, you know, how you move around this world like that, like they just showed, which is really cool on how that works into the game. Otherwise, like, I don't know, man. I can't just shoot boxes and robots and listen to a story. That's just not my thing. But they did show a Lego game as part of Gamescom Opening Night Live also that, you know, like, again, like, it looks charming like this, and I can see why people like it. It's just a little too simplistic for me.
You're talking about Lego Skywalker Saga?
Yeah, that which I think looked really cool, too. Like, I'd rather play that than this, but I'm not going to – I don't know. It's really hard for me to get excited unless I see, like, difficult platforming, world exploration, something. I don't, this is just a brawler. Like, I'm just not interested in this.
Yeah, they're not really about exploration. They're about fun gadgets and weapons.
Yeah, I think the weaponry is really original. It looks like a playable Pixar movie to me, which, like, video games have been making that claim for, like, 15 years now, but I think we're finally actually there. And just, there's on its face, it's like, oh, it doesn't look that different than a PS4 game. Then if you take a closer look, like, the density of the crowds and, you know, some of the work that's being done on the reflections and some of the work of, I don't know if we're going to get to it in this B-roll right here, but, like, sort of quickly zipping through the environments at the end of this demo, like, I don't feel like any of that could have been done last gen. Or not to this degree.
So shiny.
Yeah, speaking of shiny, the close-ups on Clank, I think the reflection on his armor or his metal look really nice.
Yeah, I suspect Miles Morales will have a few more puddles.
Yeah.
That's a throwback joke.
That was good. I want to see gameplay of that game, speaking of which. If it's coming out before this.
Yeah, it is. I mean, yeah. That's a good point. We have not gotten really a gameplay demo of Miles Morales yet.
Nope.
Okay, let's move on to another game that we learned more about this week, and it is definitely relevant to many of our interests, especially as Justin continues his playthrough of Lord of the Rings Online. Mm-hmm. Is there a quick update there, Justin?
No. I did meet. I think we're about to talk about Gollum, right?
Yeah. Yes.
You know,
meet Gollum. I chased him all around the Trollshaws. That's my quick Lord of the Rings Online update.
Oh, and that's how, then he catches up with the Fellowship and tracks them into Moria.
Yep.
Okay.
We did have a big article on the Lord of the Rings Gollum go up this week, where we learned a lot more info about the game. It's supposed to mix Prince of Persia-like stealth action, feature a branching narrative, and then expand on hints Tolkien gave about the about Smeagol to create a brand new Lord of the Rings story that aims to fit alongside the books. Gollum is broadly spent in two distinct states, either stealthily making your way past the various hulking threats of Mordor and making narrative choices as the warring personalities of Smeagol and Gollum fight for control. This is a prequel to the Lord of the Rings books, meaning Gollum has to reach a set place by the end of the game. And I thought that would mean, well, that would, you know, he's traveling through Mordor or trying to get to Mordor, and then it would end up with him being captured by Sauron's forces. But they actually say, we start our story parallel to the first book when Frodo is still in the Shire, knows nothing about anything. Gollum at that time ventures to Mordor, still desperately looking for Bilbo and the Ring. Unfortunately, he gets caught by Sauron's servants, and this is basically where our story begins.
Yeah, he gets tortured, and that's how they find out that that the Ring is in the Shire. I don't know about this game. Like, it's it's narrative driven. It's supposed to have choices, and the story branches based off your choices. But as you said, Damon, like, Lord of the Rings lore is extremely set in stone. Like, we know exactly who Gollum met and who he talked to, and, like, clearly there's gaps that they can fill in. But, like, how interesting can narrative choices and branching narrative be when, as you say, it has to circle back on itself and end in the same spot? I'm skeptical.
So, interestingly, they actually said that, yes, obviously it's going to follow the narration that we already know about or the storyline that we already know about. But there are elements of Smeagol. Obviously, the whole game is about, like, Smeagol versus Gollum. And what Gollum wants is to retain the control of the ring again and find Bilbo and figure that out. But there's other elements of like what's driving Smeagol. So as your personality is, and then therefore the gameplay is going through this conflict, I suppose there are probably side quests or something else that you can fulfill in taking on the persona of Smeagol. And that might be something that's less explored. Like, I don't know, I can imagine it's going back to his roots, like to who he was as a hobbit, who some of his family members are, maybe where they ended up, and investigating that other life that he once upon a time led before being driven mad by the ring. So I really do like, I think that there's enough meat there for that. And then the one thing that really stuck out to me was that obviously you can't do a lot of combat. Like I imagine he can throw a fish at someone's face and then maybe jump on their head and confuse them for a minute and then skulk away again. But outside of that, he's not taking on orcs or anything. So apparently you're going to be meeting NPCs and companion AI who are going to be helping you. And I think as far as my read was, you'd basically be directing and helping them. So maybe the fish throwing comes into relevance again, which is a gameplay mechanic I'm totally inventing. So don't take that at face value. But I like the idea of this game potentially making companion AI actually useful. And if it only accomplishes that, I will still be happy just for that minor bit of success.
Man, Gollum's really good at strangling people. And that is a stealth thing in games now. So maybe he could do that. But orcs, you know, generally were wearing a bunch of armor around their necks and stuff too. So that'll be interesting. I'm so hyped for this game. And I'll tell you why. Actually, Tina, one of your theories matches up really well with the geography of where Gollum ends up. Like, he does a bunch of cool things. He makes a deal with Shelob at some point, because when he comes back through with the hobbits, Shelob already knows what's going on. So that happens, and then he goes up into he goes past where he's from. He's a Stoor, which is a breed of hobbit that's from the east side of the Misty Mountains. And so he kind of travels up that way, and he doesn't know where the Shire is either. So he needs to kind of find where that is. And he starts searching his own land, right, which is there. And then he goes into the forest Mirkwood and gets caught. And he deals with Aragorn in there too a little bit. And then Aragorn captures him and puts him in jail in the forest. And the wood elves are guarding him, and the orcs attack the forest to free him. So there's all that. That's all after he talks to Sauron and that information comes out. So I think a lot of this is going to take place in this like escape from Mordor part, which is like they let him go. And then some of it's going to be stealthing around Mirkwood, hopefully, and just kind of like exploring that whole eastern side of Erebor, I think is what it is. It's really, really cool. I'm really excited for that.
It is a rich topic for a game. I guess to like rephrase, it's interesting their decision to make it narrative choice and player choice focused when that narrative is pretty established already. Like I'm trying to think of another game where the player has a lot of influence on the story and how it evolves, but then you already know the end.
Yeah, all the Star Wars prequels.
Yeah, I was very skeptical when we first learned about this game. I think it was early this year. But I like this description. This comes from the developer. Says the game is, for the most part, structured in sets of levels and hubs. When Gollum arrives at a new location, the places where he can go from that hub are limited until he either works his way in, finds secret passages or information, or manages to scheme his way into otherwise restricted areas. And that sounds totally fun. That kind of sounds like a Dishonored-like.
Yeah, or like a Metal Gear Gollum.
Yeah, like any RPG where that lets you spec in, we've talked about this before on Scoop, but any RPG that lets you spec in dialogue strength and, you know, your charm or whatever else, your intellect, is totally my jam. So it would be really cool if they had that in this, that element in this game. They haven't spoken to any kind of like RPG elements like that or leveling up, but regardless, because it's so dependent on the personality choices that you pick, it does feel like that kind of like dialogue emphasis is obviously going to be at the forefront either way. Although I will say Justin, to your point, it is obviously they're spending a lot of time trying to say like, we're not messing with the storyline. Like this is going to be the same universe that you love. There's a quote, from the developer in our piece, where he says, it won't be like you're going to end up destroying Middle Earth because you never made a Smeagol choice. But actually, I think that would be pretty cool. Like I totally don't mind a universe where Smeagol like goes in a, you know, completely different direction and really challenges elements of the story. I think that would be fun, but they're clearly trying to do this balanced thing where they still have the Lord of the Rings fans happy about not changing the basic elements, but making sure that you have your own little Smeagol storyline that maybe was never told. And then they did mention too that apparently whatever default personality you opt for actually will impact the environment in a stylistic way, which kind of reminds me of the Saboteur and how like you're basically the environment gets colored in the more that you conquer these little like the areas in the game. So that kind of thing is like a cool little aspect of it that seems like it suits the rest of their goals.
I do think all of that sounds really cool. And I'm also excited to play as Gollum. Like, you know, he's not a hero. He's not a villain. You know, we've played as children and, you know, weakling characters before, but never, like, I can't think of a game protagonist that, like, maps to this. He's just a really, really interesting, well-written, you know, well-characterized, you know, fictional character that I'm excited to get to know more.
All right, we have to take one more quick break. But right after that, we'll be back with the thrilling conclusion to GameCube. Welcome back to day two of IGN's live coverage of Gamescom 2020. You're in the midst of GameScoop, which is our weekly video game podcast. You can check out in your favorite podcast service or youtube.com/GameScoop. My name is Damon Hatfield. I'm joined by Tina Amini, Sam Claiborne, and Justin Davis. And it is time to check in with the listeners.
Hey, listeners.
Listeners, remember, you can always reach us at the email address, gamescoop@IGN.com, just like Angel from Chicago did. Angel says, been listening since 2018. Love the cast. Love the show. Listen every time. Damon, thank you so much for the recommendation of the documentary High Score on Netflix. Loved it, and I learned a lot about the gaming industry from it. I have a question regarding it as well. If there was a continuation of the series, a season two, what would be the things they would cover in the more contemporary age of video games, like the fall of Sega or the entry of Microsoft? Also, what other subjects in the era of video games that they covered already would you have liked them to have covered?
Good question. I finished it last night.
Yeah.
And it goes right up to Doom, which came out December 1993. And it also covers Star Fox, which came out earlier in that year in 1993. Mm. So in 1994, the first things that it could start with are Donkey Kong Country. This is an example of a thing that came out in 1994. And of course, the PlayStation started taking over then. And I was thinking like a good like arc would be the rise of PlayStation and compact disc based stuff or CD-ROM based stuff in the DVD, like right up to like Grand Theft Auto and like the kind of 2000 launch of the PS2 and like 3D big open world games. Cause I feel like that's kind of the era we're in, but there is an in-between era there they could cover.
Yeah. The 90s are a really rich and interesting and dramatic era for video games with, you know, Nintendo kind of betraying Sony and then that leading to the rise of PlayStation and, you know, sort of the downfall of Sega and, probably at the tail end of that, you know, depending on how many more years they wanted to cover, you could even talk about like, you know, Microsoft and sort of the origin of Xbox starting with, you know, as a spinoff of DirectX.
So I've only seen one episode, but just based off of that, it seems like they've really left themselves open for the potential to go down a lot of different angles. Because obviously, like there's the decades that they can cover just as a more general topic. But the thing that I really liked about that first episode that I saw is that they span a lot. They span like game design itself. And then like the history of it, like how certain things were programmed versus how they are nowadays. They talk about the beginnings of the competitive industry around gaming. They even talk about player behavior and dig in a little bit to the behind the scenes look at like, you know, why certain design decisions were made to kind of keep people's interest there and keep people plugging in quarters into arcade machines. And even some of the drama, which Justin and Sam already touched on in terms of continuations of different companies being competitive in the industry. So it's just a lot of different angles that they could take. Like even if you just track the pattern of the emergence of different kind of genres or the combination of genres, different patterns in game design, like that could take up an entire season for one decade alone. And then they could completely go in a different direction and talk about like the competitive scene and how it's kind of really burgeoned up to 2020. So there's just so many different angles that they touched on, even in that singular episode that I watched. It was actually pretty impressive.
Like at some point there's like a season away or two away in which it's like the MMO and online multiplayer and everything are like those are the way they do these episodes. Like, you can see those as like their own thing, but that's not, it's sequentially what happens next in history. But there's nothing saying that they have to go sequential. Maybe like the topics are big enough that it's like one episode is about Sega leaving the console market entirely, and one is about the existence of the first MMOs coming about. And, you know, I think that's, you know, a really interesting way to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. There are only 6 episodes in season 1. So it's like, there's just so many other topics they can explore in future seasons. Like they did Sega versus Nintendo in the early 1990s already. Which is a fascinating story. And then, like you're just saying, Sam, it'd be interesting to follow the sort of sad, slow downfall of Sega after that, leading up to the Dreamcast and then them exiting the console wars.
And a lot of the themes that they...
So many topics.
Yeah, a lot of the themes that they touched on, like there's a, even just in that first episode, there's an entire section about, or entire clips about lawsuits, and I guess what you could call like fan-made contributions to licensed IPs. Mm-hmm. So that's something that's still pretty topically mm-hmm. relevant. We just had news recently where there's a Left 4 Dead 2, I'm not sure exactly actually what it was. It was like a mod or something that they're actually, that Valve is officially incorporating into Left 4 Dead 2. So it's come a long way from this kind of like competitive, protective kind of era into another generation where it's kind of the normal way of things that fans are constantly making their own creations or additions or mods on top of games. So that alone could be a whole topic. You could look at like the beginnings of, since Sam mentioned MMOs, you could look at like how MMOs have morphed and then how Destiny introduced a new genre and how there were so many copycats after that. Like there's just so many even super recent examples that you could spend episodes talking about and how the impact has been, what the marketing has been around it. I love the clips of like, teenage girls reacting to Pac-Man being cute, which I don't get it. It's just, like, you know, a block of cheese, essentially.
Pac-Man's so cute.
I guess so.
What you're saying there about the research that went into this, I just wanted to call it out. Like, it's unbelievable seeing all the news clips and stuff like that. That's like one side of the research that went into that project that's just amazing, seeing, you know, commercials and news footage and everything. Then there's this other side where, like, every game that's shown in it is shown with scan lines, like probably off a CRT or at least like emulated really closely to look like one. It's incredible. Like we do this for our jobs, right? We have to capture video games and talk about video games and do research and stuff like that. So it's really cool to see that done for things that didn't come out in 2020. Like, it's really amazing seeing like new technology highlighting what Donkey Kong actually looked like on the screen in 1980. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, they have like original sketches for Space Invaders. They have, and then they do animations for scenes that they don't have. That was really cool too, how they were just sort of like animating some pitch scenes for E.T. So they definitely have like a really big multimedia backing to it.
The Space Invaders sea creatures was like so mind-blowing, because I knew like they were kind of based on sea creatures, but then you see like the one is a crab and he's like, he doesn't really look like a crab, I know.
I love the footage from the Nintendo World Championships, like the finals of the Nintendo World Championships. It's so cool. Yeah. Loved it. Red, how are we doing on time? How much time do we have left? We got 5 minutes left. That means it's time for a video game 20 questions speed round. Our suggestion this week comes from Matt Ford, and he only has a hard mode suggestion. So it's just hard mode.
Oh, boy.
Speed 5 minutes round. Hard mode. All right.
Let the questioning begin.
Expectations, set them low.
Could this game have appeared in the Netflix documentary High Score?
Wait a minute. Wait, could it have?
Based on in what? Terms of generationally?
Based off the time period that the first 6 episodes covered.
Based on the time
period? Before 1994.
Okay. Based on that time period, no.
Aw. Is this from... was this available on Switch?
No.
Is it current gen, though?
You guys don't have much time.
Is it on current-gen consoles?
But Tina, I cannot hear you.
Oh, boy.
There you go.
Okay.
Is it on current-gen consoles?
No.
Okay.
Shit, we're in trouble here. Was this game released in the 2000s?
No.
No, okay. So it's from 1994 to 1999. We got this.
That's great.
Was this on a cartridge?
No. That's 5.
Was this game released for the PlayStation 1?
Yes.
Was it an exclusive?
At the
its time.
It was for like right at release. It was.
Okay. Oh, interesting. Okay. Okay. Was this game developed in Japan?
No.
Is it part of a series?
Yes.
Is it a sports game?
No. That's 10.
Was this game developed in the United States?
Yes.
Is it 3D?
Yes.
Is the developer still around? Still in business?
Yes. I think so. In some form. In some form, yes. Mm.
Okay.
Mm. Is this a first-person game?
No.
It could be Tomb Raider.
And if it's on hard mode, it could be like a really late one or something.
I don't know why.
Does it have some level of platforming or verticality to the gameplay?
Yes. 15.
Tomb Raider.
Yeah, could be. But that, I don't know why that's hard mode. It's not.
That's true. Just be like it can't Tomb Raider
4 or something or whatever.
Yeah. Do you play as a human?
Yes.
I don't know what that eliminates. Vampire games. Are vampires human?
No. Once upon a time.
Is this set in present day?
Yes.
It's a Tomb Raider game.
Probably.
Do you explore?
Did you explore? Go ahead. I don't know. I'm not going to ask that.
Is that yeah. Is it archaeology based?
Yes.
All right. So now we got no questions to figure out which Tomb Raider it is.
Is there a dinosaur in it?
Yes.
Is it Tomb Raider?
Yes, it is the original Tomb Raider.
Okay.
Yeah, that wasn't hard mode.
That was an experiment. Matt Ford says, I'm curious if they are told they're playing on hard mode, if they can still get an Easter experiment. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was really good. That was a good experiment. I'm really mad about it, but it was a good experiment.
The hard mode is that it wasn't hard mode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because my brain was definitely thinking a different direction.
Yeah, so am I. I'm like, it's Klonoa.
Do you think we stepped up our game, though? And then we were just that much better?
I think the time constraint did it.
Yeah, you got in like 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, let's do another one.
2 minutes left.
Real hard mode one.
In the last 60 seconds? That'd be really hard.
They'll cut us off.
Yeah. They are going to cut us off. They are probably already going to be mad that we played 20 questions on our Gamescom live show. Everybody watching the stream, thanks for hanging out with us. It's early in the morning for us on Friday, almost 9 a.m. for us. So we hope you enjoyed the show. We're going to hand you over. We're going to take a quick break, then hand you over to the rest of our Gamescom live coverage for the day. We will be right back.
Anna Sheridan, New York Times bestselling author of Supernatural Horror, missing for nearly 6 months now.
That's not possible. Is the compass broken? Or did I turn to the side?
Given the circumstances of her disappearance, someone with a more vivid imagination might decide she'd pierced the veil, so to speak.
Weak radio signal. 700 meters. Closing fast.
There's no place for ghost stories and close encounters in this investigation, or any other.
I need you to find me.
To save yourself.
Of course. What else would it be?
The Sheriff's, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.